Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And we got a lot to talk about on today's podcast. Just a few moments, we're going to take a look at a unique program that is being introduced in New York City. It's already been piloted in other parts of the country, which enables a doctor to prescribe fresh fruits and vegetables for their patients. What's up with that? We'll find out in just a moment. Plus, we have some other stories in stock for you. But first, this, and this is a follow-up to the story about last week's stent surgery for former President George W. Bush. And I inveighed against that, in case you hadn't heard about it, on my weekend edition of Health Talk, that podcast available via WR710.com, also through iTunes. And you can also read an article that I wrote on the subject for the Intelligent Medicine newsletter. That newsletter available to you via radio program at AOL.com. That's the email for subscribing to our newsletter. Also, I posted that article up at drhoffman.com, or you can find it on my Facebook page. And the article is entitled, Former President G.W. Bush Gets Stampeded into Undergoing a Stent Operation. And I just wanted to go over one of the most recent examples of journalistic malpractice with regard to the Bush stent. It appeared in a Florida paper. I believe this is a West Palm Beach, Florida publication. And that is precisely the part of the country which is at the heart of our epidemic of cardiovascular disease, if you excuse the pun. But lots and lots of people are getting procedures down in Florida. And this article is by an individual named Steve Dorfman. There are no initials before or after his name, so it suggests that he is merely a lay journalist. And he precisely misses the point in terms of this G.W. Bush stent, because this is, on the national stage, this is a teachable moment, and we really ought to be able to derive some lessons from George Bush's stent surgery. He's the celebrity illness of the week, and maybe there's some lessons that we can draw from it, but Steve Dorfman takes precisely the wrong tack in covering this story. Entitled, What You Can Learn from Bush. He writes, despite being diligent about his fitness, former President George W. Bush needed to have a balloon angioplasty and accompanying stent inserted last week in order to treat a coronary arterial blockage. Okay, well, that is actually precisely wrong, because I contend that former President G.W. Bush did not need to have a balloon angioplasty and a little metal mesh inserted into one of his coronary arteries to treat his blockage. Now, that may be a bold statement, and you know where I'm coming from. I'm a longtime critic of the excesses of mainstream American medicine. I'm sort of a renegade, an outlier. My practice is based on complementary and alternative medicine. I've been doing this for nearly 30 years. My radio program is in the tradition of Carlton Fredericks, who was an iconoclast and talked about over-the-top American medical treatments with drugs and surgery decades ago, in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And so you might say, well, I'm kind of an eccentric in terms of my opinions about whether G.W. Bush should get a stent. But here's a statement from the top cardiologist in the country, Dr. Steve Nissen. He's head of cardiology at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. And he is considered the top-notch cardiologist in America. He actually may be a candidate for becoming head of HEW, of the Department of whatever it is, whatever Sebelius is now head of. he says, quote, "This is really American medicine at its worst. It's one of the reasons we spend so much on healthcare and we don't get a lot for it. In this circumstance, the stent doesn't prolong life, it doesn't prevent heart attacks, and it's hard to make a patient who has no symptoms feel better." What's he talking about? I mean, look, you got a blockage, and you got to fix it, right? If it were your toilet at home, you'd get a plumber to come in and do the Roto-Rooter treatment. But what this journalist, this naive journalist in the Florida paper, doesn't talk about is that in 2007, a study known as the COURAGE study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, showed that stents were no better than just medical therapy to treat patients, even patients who had chronic but stable chest pain. And you saw pictures of George Bush gallivanting around. In fact, in this article, Dorfman admits that George W. Bush had been pursuing an active, apparently healthful lifestyle, but he said that doesn't by itself protect you from being vulnerable to heart disease. And that's the lesson that we can derive from the stent that was put into George W. Bush. In other words, it's sort of a fatalistic approach. It's like, okay, try as you might, you can follow the best diet, you can exercise, you can take care of yourself, but you still get blockage and you need medical intervention. You know, it's not a merit system. And, you know, lest you think, you know, you're living in a la-la land of false security because you think, because you're slim, you're exercising, you're taking vitamins, you're healthy. If you think you can avoid a trip to the cardiologist to get your balloon angioplasty and your stent placement, well, you're living in a fool's paradise. That's what the purport of this article is. And the author of this article, Mr. Dorfman, writes, "His condition should serve as a stark reminder that none of us, no matter how healthy we think we are, is immune from heart disease." He says, actually in a truthful recitation of facts, he says, "Indeed, Bush's condition was diagnosed not because he was complaining of any discomfort, but rather during his routine annual exam." Well, that is incorrect. That is bad medicine, according to current guidelines, because you don't just push a stent into a partially blocked artery in an asymptomatic patient. Bush apparently he's a victim, like many high-profile patients, he's a victim of his own celebrity. He gets gold-plated medical care, which is often over-aggressive, and he had that million-dollar physical that he undergoes every year. And, you know, this year they found something suspicious on his EKG, and then a cardiac catheterization revealed that there was significant blockage in one of his coronary arteries, which led him to undergo the procedure. According to Mr. Dorfman, situation normal. That's the way it should be. And so the other lesson that Mr. Dorfman in his newspaper article believes we should learn, this brings us to the other lesson from Bush's episode that all baby boomers would be well advised to heed. Don't skip your routine annual physical exam. Your life just might depend on it. Well, according to the COURAGE trial, getting a stent has no impact on your risk of dying or even your risk of a subsequent heart attack. All it does is if you're suffering from severe incapacitating chest pain, it can relieve the pain, but that wasn't the case with Bush. So wrong information passed along to gullible readers in a place where they do landmark business in inserting stents. And if I appear too cynical talking about this, there have been some recent very celebrated cases. This is from an article in The Lancet. They talk about a guy, a cardiologist, Mark Midday, who has had his license revoked for doing unnecessary stenting. In the background of this story, The Lancet, which is Britain's leading medical journal, on one of the major medical journals in the world, writes that U.S. medical guidelines say an artery should be 50% blocked with cholesterol plaque before the disease is considered significant, and symptoms might not be apparent until there is 70% blockage. Dr. Medei exaggerated the percentage blockage in patients that he was evaluating for stent placement, and when patients had a 50% blockage, he sometimes wrote 80% blockage as a blatant falsehood that then would provide justification for the stent placement. He also sometimes cooked up symptoms that would justify stent placement by remembering afterwards, after this is after he was investigated and sued, that although he didn't record the symptoms in his patient's medical notes, he remembered. He had a distinct memory that the patient did tell them about chest pain. He just didn't bother to write it down. Nonetheless, he had his medical license suspended for 2 years. He is being sued by 220 of his patients because he did over-the-top stent placement. A Baltimore lawyer who's representing these patients says, quote, "We don't know how he got away with what he did. When he said he saw a 90% blockage and no one else did in the laboratory, no one dared question him. I guess because he was the head of cardiology. This guy was, he's not a fly by night. He was a prominent cardiologist, very well respected, doing landmark business in the Baltimore region. But stents are not inconsequential. They can, in rare cases, cause bleeding, stroke, or heart attack. Life-threatening blood clots can be caused, so patients must take blood-thinning drugs. That's not inconsequential. Most patients after stents need to be on blood-thinning drugs for anywhere from 6 years to 3 years to even for the rest of their lives. That impairs their physical activity and can cause serious bleeding episodes. You fall down after you're taking an anticoagulant, hit your head. You can have a very serious intracerebral bleed, which can cause you to die. Whereas if you hadn't been on the blood thinner, you just get a bad bump on your head, maybe a mild concussion. So in the Medei case, an investigation by the Senate Finance Committee says that he may have implanted 585 stents, which were medically unnecessary. Medicare paid $3.8 million for these procedures. According to Max Baucus, who's a Democratic senator, chair of the Finance Committee, who's investigating Dr. Medei and other cases of medical overreach, taxpayers shouldn't be paying for improper surgeries and implants. This could be a sign of a larger national trend of wasteful medical device use. You think? It's pretty incredible. Also, there's kind of an unsavory relationship between Medei and one of the big drug companies, Abbott Laboratories. I guess Abbott makes the stents. They certainly make some of the cardiovascular drugs. It's my impression they also may make medical devices. So they rewarded him after he achieved the incredible feat of inserting 30 of the company's stents in a single day. That's like it's like being an ace fighter pilot. You notch your belt, or you put like a little stents on your Mercedes to show how many stents you put in, and he achieved a company record, 30 stents in a single day. What a guy. So an Abbott sales representative spent $2,159 to buy him a whole slow-roasted pig and other culinary delights for a barbecue at Medei's home. That was his reward for being a super cardiologist. Cases like Medei's, according to a blog that I read, the Kevin MD blog. It's a blog written mostly for medical professionals. cases like Madej's force us to consider the kind of culture that could allow such a fraud to take root and go on for years, a culture that likely prized the hospitals and physicians' financial health over the clinical health of their patients. If the allegations are true, the penalty should be severe, not only for Dr. Madej, but also for leaders who knew or should have known what was going on, yet remained silent. So, we no longer can remain silent about this and miss the very important teachable message that situations like George Bush's provide us. And again, the mainstream media has let us down, as is evinced by this article in the, I guess it's the Palm Beach Herald or a local paper down there in Florida, which basically says, hey, you know, suck it up. Even though you do the best you can, you know, you maintain your weight, you eat good food, you exercise like George W. Bush, you're still going to need one of these days. And oh, by the way, keep going to the doctor, so eventually they may find something wrong with you, and that'll be an excuse to unnecessarily put in a stent. Do I sound embittered about this? Yeah, because so much about conventional medicine, so much of the excesses, the outright fraud in some cases, is condoned, whereas honest practitioners of complementary and alternative medicine are often targeted with investigations. Insurance companies deny them benefits because what they're doing is out of the mainstream. It involves efforts to improve a patient's diet, lifestyle, the use of nutritional supplements. That, in a complete reversal of priorities, that's considered less important, less hard-hitting than aggressive conventional medicine. And now for something a little more uplifting and positive. You know, New York City has been criticized lately for becoming a nanny state where our mayor, Michael Bloomberg, has by decree said that people shouldn't drink soda. He's already instituted strong anti-smoking policies. Some people are aggravated by his addition of bike lanes to already crowded city streets. And now we've got a bike program. We've got people careening around on city bikes. But it's hard to quarrel with this latest program. And the best thing about it is that it's not a taxpayer-funded program. Or to some extent, there are taxpayer funds involved through the SNAP program, a.k.a. food stamps. But these are funds that are already allocated and might be spent in a much more harmful or negative way. One of my big criticisms of the food stamp program is that it is actually an agricultural subsidy for making a lot of cheap, bad foods that can be plentifully available to people so that they can stuff their faces and, in effect, become more obese and more sick. That was a finding of a study recently. I believe it was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, where they looked at poverty-level families and compared those not on food stamps to those on food stamps. And what they found was alarming, is those on food stamps were heavier. It wasn't so much alleviating starvation as promoting obesity. And they also had a greater chance of adverse health outcomes, especially pre-diabetes and diabetes. So that's because there's this irrational rule that you can't tell people what to buy. You can't say, this is good food, this is bad food, we're going to subsidize the healthy food. Everything has to be subsidized, even candy. The only thing that doesn't get subsidized practically is cigarettes and alcohol. Those are things you can't buy with the SNAP program, but you can buy all manner of caloric junk, poor quality foods, with food stamps. So the counterpoint, I'm getting to this, is a program. Well, think of this. I wish I could see a patient and say, take a head of broccoli and a fresh garden tomato and call me tomorrow. because that is in effect what this is. It's a fruit and vegetable prescription program. Take two fruits and vegetables and call me in the morning. Under which a doctor, in tandem with a nutritionist, can assess the health and nutritional habits of patients and families at risk for obesity and provide prescriptions in quotation marks. And they're not really prescriptions, but they're suggestions that emanate from a medical office to consume more fruits and vegetables. And they're now developing a pilot program in New York City for the first time at Lincoln Medical Center in the Bronx. Now, this is a very underserved area of the Bronx, actually where I studied, part of the catch basin for Albert Einstein Medical School in the Bronx, also Harlem Hospital Center in Manhattan. They've got a Come See What's Cooking Kids program to bring food-based nutrition education to kids at four city farmers markets. I've seen this at my local farmers market. They try to bring kids to the farmers market to show them what really healthy food looks like. Now, if you think that's unnecessary, just go to a typical, even suburban supermarket. You don't have to go to the inner city, but even in the suburbs, where you'll see some sallow kid from high school who's working the cash register for you, and you've got a supermarket basket that's full of fresh fruits and vegetables. And as they sort of sullenly pick through your groceries, marking down what they cost and putting them into a shopping bag, sometimes they'll pick up a common fruit or vegetable that have no idea what it is. And I've seen this happen with things like turnips and even just some real common fruits like kale. They don't know what kale is. They have to, like, price check. What is this? They ask me. So we need to make kids more familiar with healthy foods. New York City also has the largest municipal farmers market SNAP incentive program in the nation, which is good because regardless of what you think of food stamps, it's not going away. And at least let's hook food stamps to healthy foods. So this makes fruits and vegetables more affordable. And they've expanded something called the Health Bucks program, which provides $2 coupons for fresh produce at farmers markets. Health Bucks will make more than $560,000 worth of fruits and vegetables available to low-income New Yorkers. That's an increase of 32% over the previous season. So they got all these people in government joining with people in private industry, foundations, the insurance industry, and it's a good thing, says Deputy Mayor Deputy Mayor Linda Gibbs. She says each dollar invested in fruit and vegetable prescription program nourishes public hospital patients and their families, boosts revenue at farmers markets, and supports overall community health. What's also good about this is that this is it provides a subsidy of a sort for the farmers who, in a dedicated way, make really fine local produce. Some of it is organic. At least it is at the farmers market that I shop at across the street from me here in Midtown Manhattan. They come once a week. And so at least there's a government subsidy for them, not the makers of corn or wheat products that can be made into a refined ultra-caloric food. I mean, those farmers out there in the Midwest, they get great subsidies. Why not small community farmers that are providing artisanal vegetables and fruits in season? Dr. Thomas Farley, who's the health commissioner here in New York, he says, a food environment full of processed foods, full of fat, sugar, and salt is contributing to obesity, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, cancer, and chronic diseases. He sure has that right. And they call it the FVRX, the Fruit and Vegetable Prescription Program, is a creative approach that will enable at-risk patients to visit any of our 142 farmers markets. I didn't know there were 142 farmers markets in New York. and purchase the fruits and vegetables that will help them stay healthy. Okay, well, you can bring a horse to water, but can you make them drink? They say yes. I mean, you could be cynical about this and just say, well, look, I mean, this is not what these people want. Some of these people, they've got, you know, really, really funky food attitudes. They've already become hooked on junk foods. And the well-meaning efforts of do-gooders is not going to deter them from reaching the object of their affection, which is, Antman's pastries. But what they say is that it has made a difference. And, you know, what we're seeing is something encouraging. There's a very slight downtick. The latest statistics show a very slight downtick in childhood obesity and diabetes. For the first time in a while, it's been a trend that's going up, up, up. And we thought it was just going to go through the roof. But there's a slight downtick. Maybe it's a statistical glitch and it will resume its upward trend. But, if you're a fan of the administration, you will credit Michelle Obama. The New York Times, however, writing an article on the subject of why kids are not becoming obese at the previous rate. I mean, they still are at an alarming rate, but there's a little bit of a downturn in the trend. They say it's unclear why. Maybe, just maybe, people are developing a sense of personal responsibility, and they're teaching their children to eat better food. They're shopping more smart and avoiding junk for their kids. Maybe it's the efforts of pediatricians finally getting through to parents to feed their kids better. So the way it works is if you are considered overweight or at risk, overweight and obese children and pregnant women will be enrolled by their primary care providers as FVRX participants. Then a primary care provider and a nutritionist meet with participants and their families each month to reinforce the importance of healthy eating. That's good. I'm glad there's an insurance code for that rather than providing drugs. The provider distributes FVRX prescriptions during the visit and assesses fruit and vegetable consumption and body mass index. Well, I have a problem with that. Body mass index, very poor marker for obesity. I wish they had body fat composition machines that would measure fat to lean ratio. That's a better, and those machines are not terribly expensive. They could be installed at each location or each primary care doctor's office where they make these assessments. That I have a problem. BMI, we've often assailed that as a marker of health. A prescription represents at least one serving of produce per day for each patient and each family member, equal to a dollar a day. For example, a family of four would receive $28 per week. That's a little skimpy. I mean, hopefully that'll go some ways toward providing people with healthier food. But at the farmer's market that I shop at, I got two exquisitely delicious. They were ambrosial. Two medium-sized white peaches sent me back $4. A pint of fresh strawberries, $4. A pint of fresh blueberries or cherries, $4. And admittedly, that would be good. Yeah, I guess you could get, that's not too bad. Maybe you get seven servings of those a week. That might make a dent in the health of a family of four, but it seems like kind of a low allocation, but I guess that's all that's available. Prescriptions can be redeemed weekly for fresh fruits and vegetables at participating farmers markets throughout the 4 to 6 month program. Participants will then return to their healthcare provider monthly to refill their FVRX prescription and set new goals for healthy eating. So very cool. I like it. I just wish that, I mean, this is a positive effort, but I wish that there was a way to stem the tide of junk food that is subsidized by the federal government. 50% of Americans are now on food stamps. That's an alarming statistic. And they tried, Mayor Bloomberg, like him or hate him, he tried something good, which was to place limits on the kind of foods that people could buy with food stamps. And the federal government knocked him down. They said, no, it's a federal program. You're a local government. You do not have authority to make rules or restrict a federal program. Federal government trumps the local government. But hey, isn't it the local government that has to pick up the tab for a lot of the health care bills of the people who are coming down sick as a result of this poor quality food? That's a problem I have with the federal government's refusal to acknowledge that local governments can enforce standards. And they weren't unreasonable standards about what you could buy or not buy with food stamps. I mean, after all, this is a supplementary program. And so if you want to buy Oreo cookies or if you want to buy, sweetened drinks, you know, sodas and stuff like that, buy it on your own dime. Don't buy it on the taxpayer's dime. That's not, you know, part of the four essential food groups. Junk is not considered essential for staving off malnutrition. This is called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, not, buy whatever you want. But unfortunately, that initiative got overturned by government bureaucrats. I think they more want to protect agriculture and agribusiness and food conglomerates who make these products than the people who consume them. It's a big government handout to goose the economy by providing big agricultural and food subsidies to the detriment of the population. I'm glad to see this initiative underway in New York, and I hope it works out, and I hope it gets expanded, and I hope that a lot of generous philanthropies line up behind it. I participate in something along these lines at the YMCA. It's called the YDPP, the Y Diabetes Prevention Program, where as part of the Y's activities, we talk about the mission of the Y. The Y is a place where kids can come and exercise. They can get character-building experiences there, and exercise is good for maintaining health and keeping you out of trouble. But nutrition is an important part of growing up to be a healthy adult. So the Y Diabetes Prevention Program allows children and their families to go for counseling sessions at the Y to get them on better diets so they can stave off chronic disease, which will impair their lives and ultimately cost the taxpayers a lot of money. By the way, the Y, not a federal, state, or local program. It's a private philanthropy that raises money from individuals and private corporations. And that's to the good, because often when the government initiates programs like this, it's big, it's bureaucratic, it's not flexible, it's not local enough, and the Y does a good job of dealing with local needs. They know the communities that they serve, and the YDPP program also offers some really good early intervention to stave off obesity and chronic disease. They probably are going to team up with the this new program, the Fruit and Vegetable RX program, to get people to follow healthier diets. I personally did some of this work when I was in medical school. I ventured out into the Bronx community. At the time, I ran cooking classes. That was actually a job that I did to help fund going through medical school, and I offered free classes to members of the Bronx community on how they can make their food dollars go farther and more nutritiously. Rather than blowing the food budget on 22-ounce sirloin steaks, there's a lot you could do with less expensive cuts of meat, mixing it with vegetables, Chinese style, or even Mexican style, Hispanic type cooking, where meat is not the biggest slab of meat on the plate, but it's an accoutrement to cooking healthy vegetables. And then, brown rice, last time I checked, not exorbitant. Rice and bean combinations with healthy natural cheeses provide an excellent balance of protein. And you can stretch your food budget farther and make your family healthier. It doesn't take a heck of a lot of time to implement some of these changes. And finally, our nutrition story of the day And it has to do with the condition that bedevils many people, especially for some reason, women after the time of menopause, but it can affect all people at all ages at all times. It's dry eye. And dry eye can sometimes be a sign of a disease like Sjogren's syndrome, which is a dry mucous membrane medical condition. It is sometimes, even without full-blown Sjogren's syndrome, it is associated with autoimmunity. It is associated with menopause and depletion of estrogen. But it's also associated with all the ubiquitous causes of eye strain, staring into computers, being inside in very dry environments with air conditioning, air pollution, the presence of chemicals indoors, sick building syndrome, and overall allergies. There's a lot of causes of dry eye. But the nutritional support that I often suggest for dry eye involves a lube job. But unlike for your car, we're talking about an internal lubrication. Taking essential fatty acids by mouth can provide you with an inner lube job, which ultimately helps to relieve dry eye. And a new study backs that up. This study just in from the medical journal Cornea. The cornea is the external part of the eye. And there's an entire medical journal. Talk about specialized medical journals. It's not just devoted to eye diseases. It's entirely devoted to diseases of the cornea. And the title of this article is Long-Term Supplementation with Omega-6 and Omega-3 Polyunsaturated Fatty Acids Improves Moderate to Severe Keratoconjunctivitis Sica, which is, this is one of the reasons that I went to medical school, is so that I could understand and pronounce words like keratoconjunctivitis, Sica, which translation, and I'll send you a bill, because turning stuff into medical jargon is a billable medical service. Keratoconjunctivitis, Sica, is a fancy word for dry eye. So long-term supplementation with omega-6 and omega-3s improves moderate to severe dry eye, a randomized double-blind clinical trial. This study investigated the effects of supplementation with gamma-linolenic acid, not just any omega-6 fatty acid. You know, we talk about how the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio is wrong in this country. There are good and bad omega-6 fatty acids. Omega-6 fatty acids that come from corn oil and other cheap oils, these were all the, you know, during the Mazola era, remember they said, you know, take a lot of Mazola oil and make your family healthier. No, it turns out that margarines that are laden with omega-6 fatty acids may be a cause of inflammation and disease, heart disease, even cancer. So the superior form of omega-6 is something called GLA, gamma-linolenic acid, which comes from borage oil. It comes from black currant, seed oil, and, of course, primrose oil. Taking that along with omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids was linked to a reduction in the production of inflammatory mediators that are linked to the chronic condition. They measured some of the cytokines, which are active substances in the bloodstream and in the tissues that promote inflammation. And what they found is that they were reduced. Also, subjectively, the supplement improved ocular irritation symptoms, maintained corneal surface smoothness, and it inhibited conjunctival dendritic cell maturation. I don't know. I've got to admit, I don't know what that means, but I think that's a bad thing, and it should be inhibited because if too much of it happens, it's going to mess up the cornea of your eye. So you want to inhibit whatever it is I just said. Prior to the study, clinical evidence showing that nutritional supplements were beneficial in treating dry eye was scarce. However, with this study, the group who was treated with, this is going to turn out to be a supplement. It's called Hydro-I, but it's a combination of GLA and omega-3 fatty acids, EPA and DHA. They had statistically significant improvements in irritation symptoms of dry eye and no progression of ocular surface inflammation or corneal irregularity. By contrast, the placebo group's dry eye symptoms actually worsened over the six-month testing period. So this is going to be a proprietary product, Hydro-I. That may be fine, but I don't see the problem in supplementing with generous amounts of GLA. I prefer borage oil, and I generally give patients two capsules of borage oil daily and anywhere from 4 to 6 capsules of ultra-potent 1,000 milligram EPA DHA. The product that I like is called Ortho-Mega. I think the GLA product I use is Ultra-GLA. And while this trial studied postmenopausal women, they say the largest group of dry eye sufferers, we think the benefit should apply to other populations suffering from dry eye, since inflammation is believed to be a common thread in dry eye. So there you have your nutrition tip of the day. Take GLA and EPA DHA. That combination works well for dry eye. And I just want to make an additional announcement. We mention this from time to time here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcasts. We welcome you listeners. This is what I love to do. Getting information out is part of my mission statement in life, but producing these podcasts and gathering the information for these podcasts is time-consuming and cost-intensive. And one of the ways that we can help to defray the costs of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast and continue bringing them to you on a regular basis is via our website, drhoffman.com, and it's a very fine store. We have a dispensary there where we offer all the products that we offer to our patients at the Hoffman Center, those products that are legally prescribable over the internet. Certain products are prescription products only available to our patients, but the vast majority of products are available via drhoffman.com, and we suggest that you go there, go to the store, check out the products there, and consider using those products to help support this educational activity. And lest you think that, oh, well, you know, I'm going to pay a premium for doing that, we have a cost match program. It's our price guarantee where, let's say you find a product there like our olive leaf product, and it's available somewhere else for cheaper, we will match the price and provide it to you. You can shop via the internet. You can click on the product you like and order via the internet. It's more economical that way. Or you can call our dispensary. The number is 212-779-1744. And speak to Grimaldi or Joey. Those are the people who man our dispensary. And you can ask them whatever you like about our products. And we'd love to have you participate as listeners to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Also, please subscribe to our newsletter. That's free as well, just like this podcast. And that's available by emailing us to a radio program at AOL.com. Just email us, tell us that you want our newsletter and that you like the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. And we'll put you on the newsletter subscription list and you'll receive regular Intelligent Medicine newsletters. And that'll help you become a more informed listener to these podcasts. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Health. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Health Talk, of course, our weekly radio program on the WR Radio Network. Podcasts of that are available at WR710.com. Until the next time, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us.